Welcome to The Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder-Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. We finished last week 16, so chapter 17. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, and there was a synagogue of the Jews, and Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them about the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and to raise from the dead, and saying, Yeshua, whom I proclaim to you, is the Messiah. And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. All right, stop there for a minute. I've explained in the past, and it's certainly worth mentioning again, one of the major accelerants, if you will, of Christianity were high-class women in places like Greece and Rome and so forth. The deal was that if you were a sophisticated person, which is to say rich, it was considered a mark of societal sophistication that your wife would be doing something interesting. And it still is today. I mean, nothing new under the sun. But one of the things that high-class Greek women would do would be go to the synagogue and would, you know, learn a little Hebrew, listen to the Scriptures and that kind of stuff, and it was a mark of sophistication. Well, these ladies are also extremely well connected in society. Any woman who can take time off to, I'll use a pejorative word here, dabble in the synagogue is somebody who isn't spending her days on her hands and knees washing clothes on a rock in the street. So they're well off, and so when they became persuaded of Christianity, Christianity then had an entree into the upper levels of Greek and Roman society by virtue of these women. You'll see mentioned over and over again these high-class women who are in the synagogues that Paul talks to. So now to verse 5. But the Jews were jealous, and taking some of the wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. I do not know who Jason is. We'll see Jason again in one of Paul's letters, I think Romans. Never does say who he is, but he's apparently somebody with whom Paul and Silas are staying. But this, the Jews were jealous. One of the reasons they would have been jealous is having these high-class women in the synagogue is a source of income. In other words, when they would come in and hear the Torah read and talk about the books of the rabbis and, you know, all this kind of stuff, it's sort of like Madonna studying Kabbalah right now. It's sort of the same phenomenon. And in that process, there's money coming in because these are well-connected, well-off ladies. So when it becomes apparent that they're maybe somebody who is going to take the affections and the donations of these ladies away, there is some jealousy there. All of this sort of plays in into the scenario. And as I said, I don't know who Jason is. So now we're down to verse 6. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, these men who have turned the world upside down have come here also. And Jason has received them, and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Yeshua, and the people in the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things, and when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. All right. The last thing that happens here is the secular authorities basically put Jason and his family under bond. It's like when you get arrested, you get to put up a bond and they turn you loose. And if you don't show back up for trial, you forfeit your bond, and then they, you know, send people after you anyway. What this would be is be a peace bond, where they put a bond and say, you guys will keep the peace, which means that these guys are not going to continue to cause trouble in town. We talked last time about what the problem is with what they're preaching, and there's two problems. Last time the charge was simply they were doing what ought not to be done, and we talked about that in the context of the cult of Caesar, which is to say Caesar was regarded as a demigod. When a Roman emperor died, the Senate deified him, which then made his son, who was sitting on the throne, the Son of God. It was a loyalty test to Rome. Every so often you had to go to some temple. Didn't matter which one. You know, you could go to the temple of Zeus or the temple of Apollos or the temple of, you know, doesn't matter. But you got to go to one of them, and you have to offer a symbolic pinch of incense in that temple to Caesar. If you didn't do that, you were regarded as a traitor, and of course the penalty for that was crucifixion. And as I said last time, later on, as the empire developed, they had these little books called labelli, which means little book in Latin, where the presiding priest would stamp your little book when you came in and made your pinch of incense sacrifice, so that anybody that checked on you would know that you were in fact a loyal citizen. I also said that Jews were exempt from doing this. They had what was called a religio licita, which means a legal religion, which was a religion of long standing antedating the cult of Caesar, and besides that they wouldn't do it. So they were specifically exempt. There's two charges. Charge one is these guys are coming into the synagogue and they are preaching this Messiah. The Gentiles are getting all excited about this Messiah, and they are turning to the worship of this Messiah guy, and they will turn away from the worship of Caesar. And we know that does happen. Okay, so that's sort of charge one. Charge two is Paul is preaching that Yeshua is the Son of God. Well, in the Roman system, there is already a Son of God, and that's Caesar. So for Yeshua and the followers of Yeshua to make the claim that Yeshua is the Son of God goes head to head against the Roman cult. What the Jews are setting up is, hey, Romans, this is not just a little Jewish theological dispute in which you had no interest. Because remember, in another city, they went before the magistrate, and the magistrate looks at him and says, this is a Jewish theological discussion. Why are you bringing him to me? Isn't any of my business? I don't care. So what they're saying is, you really do need to care, because the religion they're promoting goes head to head against Caesar, and it also will have these Gentiles refusing to sacrifice their pinch of incense, and it's just going to turn the whole imperial system upside down. So you civil authorities better pay attention to this. That's the argument that the Jews are making. So anyway, they put them under a peace bond and turn them loose. So now we're down to verse 10. The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. Now these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Everybody in Christianity wants to be a Berean. And not without reason. I'm not saying that as a put down. I'm just simply saying it's a very familiar passage. It becomes one of those cliches, if you will, in Christianity. Again, not that it's bad, it's just simply everybody wants to be a Berean. The other thing to understand, and you all know this very well, is that the scriptures that they were consulting was the Tanakh. Because at this point, not even the letters of Paul have been written. Paul's letters are the oldest Christian documents that I know of. The Gospels were written sometime later. So the scriptures we're talking about here are the Tanakh, the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. So what Paul is arguing for is the messiahship of Yeshua from the Tanakh. 12. Many of them therefore believed, with not a few Greek women of high standing as well as men. Again, ding, 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 ding. Here we are again with the high-born Greek women. But when the Jews from Thessalonica learned that the word of God was proclaimed by Paul in Berea also, they came there too, agitating and stirring up the crowds. Then the brothers immediately sent Paul off on his way to the sea, but Silas and Timothy remained there. Those who conducted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and after receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they departed. Paul appears to be the lightning rod in all this. And I will gently suggest to you that probably has to do with Paul's personality. Paul, you get the impression, is kind of starchy. Notice that they don't have Silas and Timothy leave, just Paul, because he's really what I would say the spark plug of the operation. He's the one that does the debating in the synagogues, and he's the articulate one, and he's the one who understands the scriptures the best. So he's the one that's sort of after. Verse 16. Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Yeshua in the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting?" Several things going on here. Since probably the time of Abraham, the idea of these Greek philosophers meeting in the agora, which is the marketplace, and discussing philosophy has been a tradition in Athens. So for him to be in the same place and preaching the gospel, he would naturally run into these itinerant philosophers who would, you know, hold their classes in the same area. Areopagus is Mars Hill, which is the hill where the Temple of Mars was. Interestingly, I remembered from my high school education, which is a long time ago, felt very proud that I could remember it, Areopagitica. Some of you may remember if you had a high school education that includes some of the classics. Areopagitica is a speech given by John Milton, who's the guy that wrote Paradise Lost. And it's an anti-censorship speech that was given in 1644 in England. And it was called Areopagitica, after this same place. Not, however, after the same incident, because a Greek philosopher made a speech for freedom of thought in the same place, and so Milton was playing off the Greek philosopher, not off of Paul. But you'll see Areopagus or Areopagitica show up lots of places, sort of an aside, in case you ever run into it again. I can remember studying this back in the Episcopal Church. And one of the things that struck me, there was a guy there, educated man. I think his major was English. He was a PhD in English. And he was saying, well, all these pagan idols and stuff, the intelligentsia in this, they didn't believe that stuff. This was all just for the bourgeoisie. And the question is, how do you know that? And the answer is, you don't. What this is a later Enlightenment gloss on the ancients. In other words, intellectuals of the Enlightenment have lost their faith in God. Their heroes are Greek philosophers. So what they're doing is projecting backward on these people and saying, well, the really sophisticated ones didn't really believe all this stuff anyway. There's no evidence for that. And in fact, all of the evidence is that they did believe it. The other thing that's happening here is you're seeing an early collision between a Hebrew God and Greek philosophy. We've spoken about this lots of times before. Different languages and different ways of thought are good for different things. And I've cast that for you in computer terms. I, you know, speak 6 or 8 computer languages. And the one I choose depends on what problem I'm trying to solve. Move back and forth between them, among them, several times a day. Work in one language for an hour or two and then switch over to another one and work in that. It just depends on what I'm trying to do. It's the same thing with human language. Greek is a really, really good language to describe nature. because that's what it's designed to do. It's a really, really good language for engineering. It's a really, really good language for science. Okay, as I've said before, if you need to go to the moon, Greek's your language, because that will enable you to think about the engineering systems that you need to put together. It's designed to do that, and it's really good. It is not, however, primarily designed to talk about God. Hebrew is designed to talk about God, and Hebrew then tacks on the engineering stuff, whereas Greek is designed to talk about the physical world, and it tacks on the God stuff. And so what Paul is doing now is running into these Greek philosophers, and let's go ahead and read it, and we'll talk about it as we go along. Pick it up at 19. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. And again, this is very human. It's especially human in the messianic churches. As I was saying to somebody the other day, every one of us is coming out of something. You know, I don't know of anybody except the children in our congregation and similarly who have grown up in this. We all grew up in something else, and we discovered that that something else was in some way unsatisfying. And we came here. In that process, as we study Torah from what we hope is a Hebrew perspective, we discover that a great deal of the things that we learned as children are perhaps not quite correct. As you do that, there's a tendency to sort of dump everything. Gee, if that's not correct, we'll dump everything. I've been in this long enough so that I've seen lots of people come through, and you have people that'll come and they'll just say, "All this Christian stuff is bunk." And that's a fairly common reaction. The point I'm making is, when you come out of something, your tendency is to sort of overshoot where you came out of. Typically what happens is if you stay with it long enough, you sort of come, you know, swing back and forth a few times, and you settle into what you think. One of the phenomenon that goes with that is what lots of people call itching ears. Somebody comes through here with a 3-day pass and a briefcase and has got a new take on this, that, or the other thing, and people will just flock from miles around to come in here and listen to this guy. That's what's going on here. Paul has showed up. He's clearly an educated man. He's clearly articulate. He's clearly teaching a new and different philosophy. So everybody says, "Ooh, what's this guy talking? You know, what's he selling? You know, obviously got a 3-day pass and a briefcase. What's he selling?" So that's what's happening here in Athens. So now we're all the way down to verse 22. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." Okay, now a couple of things going on. One of the things that you will all run into, if you haven't, I can't imagine anybody hasn't, is people who will say, "I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual." That's what Paul is dealing with here. And furthermore, since their mindset is Greek, and since Greek is based on observation and logic, they are covering all their bets by saying it is possible that there is a God out there that we have not observed. And notice also that that's contrary to Revelation, because if God shows up on the top of the mountain, gathers all of his people in front of them, and speaks so that everybody in the audience, in the nation, hears his voice, then you really logically don't have to worry that you've missed somebody. But logically, these people have not had a revelatory experience with a God. The gods at this point are cultural. In other words, all these gods are from antiquity at that point. We're talking about the year 40 in the Common Era. Gods are from 800, 900 years ago. So the last manifestation of any of these gods, if there was one, and I believe that there was because I think they are demons, has been several hundred years in the past. So these folks are going on faith, just like anybody else, but it's a faith based on logic. And so what they're doing is they're logically covering their bets. Verse 24, before 24. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live in all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. So what he's saying is, this unknown God that you have, this temple, you know, sort of insurance temple, just in case we missed one, we have this insurance shrine. I'm telling you that this God that you do not know is the creator of heaven and earth. And furthermore, he doesn't need you to serve him because everything you have is from him. Furthermore, he created humanity from the man he created. The nations came forth, and he then allotted them their territory on the earth. He also, when he, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel they were their way toward him and find him. So the idea here is he has placed man on earth, scattered him. Remember, we did the Tower of Babel this week, scattered them to all the corners of the earth, and the hope there is that then they would find their way back to him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. According to my notes in my translation, the first is probably from Epimenides of Crete. In him we live and move and have our being. We are indeed his offspring, from Aratus' poem, Pinomena. Those are both Greeks. So what he's doing is he is quoting Greek philosophy or Greek poetry back to them, sort of make a connection. Notice what he's done. He's arguing in Greek style with them. So the first thing he says is, I come representing this unknown God. This unknown God created everything. This unknown God created humanity. This unknown God scattered humanity over the earth with the hopes that they would find their way back to him. This unknown God is near us. Those are the premises of his argument. He is asserting those things as postulates. He's not trying to prove them. He is simply asserting them. You all remember from your geometry you had axioms and postulates? A postulate is something that cannot be proven. You simply state it, and you accept it, and then you argue from there. So what he's done is he has laid out a series of postulates. There's an unknown God. You've recognized that. I'm telling you about him. He created everything. He created you. He scattered humanity. He hopes you'll come back to him, and he's near to you. So those are postulates in the argument that he's putting together. So now, 29. Being God's offspring, notice that he is now referring to one of the postulates that he has just stated. In other words, he stated that we're God's offspring without proof, other than to refer to this Greek poem, and which is by way of saying, hey, you guys know the same thing. You know, your poetry says the same thing that I'm saying. We're on the same sheet of music here, but he's not trying to prove it. He's simply asserting it. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. What has he just said? This is, again, a logical argument. We are God's offspring. Well, look at your children. Are your children's parents made out of stone? No. They're you. They're people. They're human. So if we're God's offspring, then God can't be made out of stone. They can't be God because we're God's offspring. And we're not stone. You know, we're not little pebbles running around. So our parents can't be rocks. Yeah, no, that's what he's doing here. He's putting together a logical argument. So, being God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. So what he's saying is, humanity cannot recursively create its own parents or its own father. In other words, the child cannot create the father because the child proceeds from the father. 30. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. So now he's saying, I am telling you that this God is just. And remember, we talked in the past, and I've talked in the past couple of weeks, that God created a moral universe. Pagans recognize this. The concept of karma, that's an Eastern religious way of saying that God created a moral universe. So the idea that God created a moral universe is not something that only Hebrews understand. Everybody understands it. So for him then to refer to a righteous God who is going to judge this creation is something that resonates with people. Furthermore, he's saying that the judgment will be by a man. Well, okay, that's a stretch now. For God to judge the world, okay, we can all get behind that. But for a man to judge the world on God's behalf, that becomes a stretch. And what Paul then says is God demonstrated and proved this by raising that man from the dead. Again, you see the argument that he's putting together? 32. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, we will hear you again about this. So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom were Dionysus the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. The philosophical reaction to Paul's set of assertions is some of them, you know, looked like he's, you guys are smoking Eastern rope. Others of them said, huh, we need to think about this and we need to talk some more about this. In other words, you have made a case that we find sufficiently compelling that we need to explore this further. And then some simply bought it. Dionysus and Damaris and a number of others simply said, yeah. You had three different and distinct reactions to the same logical argument, which is true. You had those who said, you're full of cornflakes. You had those that said, okay, your argument's sound, but we need, basically I would suggest, we need to investigate your postulates. I'm putting words into their mouths, okay? But those who say we need to talk more about this, I'm going to suggest the nature of their indecision is we need to investigate your postulates. Because if your postulates are true, your argument is logical. And then there's a third set of people who said, yeah. It goes back to the parable of the soils. Some soil is receptive, some is not. Some is rocky, and you know, you never know. One of the things that gets thrown at believers is that you are irrational. Paul is not irrational. Paul here is using a Greek logical form. He is using it correctly, and he is laying out an argument that leads to a conclusion. The only place that this fails is, as I say, whether or not you buy the postulates, the basics. Okay? So when people say that Christians are illogical, I mean, some of Christians, of course, are illogical. I mean, people just like anybody else. But there isn't anything illogical about Christianity. The problem that they're attacking is they don't believe the postulates. In fact, the logical argument against atheism is far more compelling than the logical argument against God. Would somebody like to close in prayer?